Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 154, in which Dr. Richard Laub, formerly of the Buffalo Museum of Science, summarizes his 29 years of leading the Byron Dig. So obviously it's going to be very difficult to squeeze 3 decades of fieldwork and research into just 1 hour of audio. So you've got 2. And in this first part of the interview, we look back at how the dig got started and set in place all of the geological context needed to understand the site, ready for the second part, where we go into all the details about the plants and animals discovered there, and finally, we piece together its geological history over the last 13,000 years. I feel this episode is a wonderful follow-on to our last, where we were able to get a snapshot of time right at the discovery of a new Lagerstätte, Castlebank. Here though, we're essentially looking back at a job well done, evaluating how it went, how hypotheses changed and evolved over time as new information came to light, and how we got to our current understanding of the site. This episode was based on Dick's recently published book, 2 Acres of Time, in which he goes into so much more depth than we could ever get with like a day's worth of audio. It's a wonderful book that I read fully before the interview, and I thoroughly recommend it to anyone who's interested. There is just so much in there that we don't even touch upon, and any one of those stories could be a PaleoCast episode in its own right. Fortunately, for one of our listeners, we've got a copy of the book to give away. So for your chance to win, I'd like for you to comment on one of our original social media posts. It's a lot easier for me to find that way. I want to know as to where you think you could do 30 years of fieldwork. Perhaps you'd like to camp out in the Gobi Desert every year for a few decades. Or maybe you could get extremely well acquainted with the Burgess Shale as you work there until 2053. You could even discover a new site in your own backyard, which would be incredibly convenient. Why not? And we'll pick a winner at random just before part 2 of this interview, and we'll announce the winner then. This book really makes you feel like you're there at the site with Dick at that time. And if you like the idea of being amongst it all, discovering new specimens and species, then you might want to consider subscribing to our Patreon. In this year's virtual field trip, I actually went to Castlebank, and there in the pouring rain and gale force winds, I was able to find a new species live on camera. And I haven't yet been told that it's not a new species, so I'm still hoping that, you know, probably in 30 years' time, that we'll be able to discuss it on a future episode. So don't miss out on that discovery. And as always, all of the pictures to accompany this episode are available on our website, and all of the likes, shares, comments, reviews, and whatever else you can do for us to raise our profile online is all very much appreciated. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Dick. Thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
It has been a pleasure to be reading your book over the last few weeks. And I have a whole script filled with questions for you. So I hope you're ready.
I am ready and looking forward.
Right. But before we get started with the details, as we do every time, we want to know about you, and we want to know a bit about your journey to where you got to today, your academic journey. So how did you get into paleontology?
Well, I grew up in New York City with an easy reach of the American Museum of Natural History, and my favorite place to be was that museum, and especially the Dinosaur Hall. Whenever my parents would want to reward me for something, they would take me to the Dinosaur Hall. And that is how I got into it. I never thought I would be a paleontologist because I thought that finding a fossil was an extremely rare event. And then one day when I was at the museum speaking to one of the scientists, I met a fellow who was somewhat older than I, a late teenager, I guess, who told me about a place on the shore of New York City, where rocks had been dumped that had been brought down from up in the Hudson River, and that these rocks had a lot of fossils in them. And I went down there and started collecting fossils. And that showed me that it was possible to collect fossils and to study them. And by bringing some of my fossils in to the paleontologist at the American Museum of Natural History and discussing them with him, I became very interested in it, realized I could become a paleontologist, and in fact wound up volunteering for him, and he eventually became my mentor.
Ah, brilliant. So which kind of groups did you get started with first? Was it all of those, well, whatever you found dredged out of the Hudson, did you say?
Yes, from the rocks upstate are in many places are rich in fossils in upstate New York, whereas in New York City they are not. It's glacial debris and metamorphic rock there. So these fossils were Devonian in age, and they were marine. They were brachiopods, seashells of various types, corals, and that type of thing. And there were even the types that could be extracted using a little bit of acid. So I learned a little bit of preparation technique in the process.
Okay, so did you stick with those? Did you try and get into dinosaurs? Did you have a paper on Eurypterid biomechanics? Any of those things? Did you meander around everything?
Well, those things came later, but initially I went into invertebrate paleontology because being a young fellow and romanticized about paleontology, I wanted to do what my mentor was doing, and he was a specialist in corals. So I decided, well, then that's what I'll do. And that's what I did my master's and doctoral work on. And that's what I began my research career in, is corals, specifically tabulate corals.
Okay. That I didn't expect that, considering the subject of what we're talking about in today's interview. But what are you doing now? What's your current role?
Well, right now I'm retired. I've been retired from my work at the museum for a number of years. I served as the curator of geology at the Buffalo Museum of Science for 38 years. And initially, as I said, my research work there was on fossil corals, and I published a couple of papers on those. I was always interested in dinosaurs, and I just decided I'd educate myself a little bit about them, because during my doctoral studies, my professor, Kenneth Castor, had me teaching a course on historical geology, or rather doing the labs, and that involved vertebrate paleontology as well. So I came to really appreciate vertebrate paleontology and decided I'd educate myself about dinosaurs. So I already had a bit of a grounding, at least in vertebrate anatomy at that point.
Okay, I didn't know Castor was your mentor. It's the name I've come across so many times in my research. Anyway, that's a whole other subject. We could do a Castor episode. That'd be amazing.
Oh yeah.
Oh. Anyway, but we're not talking about any of that today. We are talking a lot more recent. So a lot. I mean, how many years? 3 decades, essentially, you have been examining and digging up a site in, what would you call it, Byron?
Yeah, the town is Byron. It's between Buffalo and Rochester, New York, and Western New York.
Okay. What's the site called?
We call it the Hiscock site.
The Hiscock
in
site.
Honor of the family that allowed us to dig there.
Okay, so please could you give us an introduction to the Hiscock site?
Well, the Hiscock site first came to light in a publication, well, in 1959, when the owner of the land decided that he wanted to flood a low damp meadow in order to make a pond for waterfowl, as I understand it. And in the process of digging, right around an active spring at that point, they turned up large bones that clearly were not from a domestic animal. It's common to find horse bones or cow bones, animals that get buried on farms, but these clearly did not were not from a domestic animal. And the curator of geology at that time, who was Carol Huybush, wrote a little article on mastodons and mammoths in New York State, in Western New York. Well, excuse me, in New York State. And she included in it a brief mention of the site in Byron. So when I came there to work in 1973, I began trying to familiarize myself with what was going on and what was there in Western New York, so that I could be more involved with the local research. And I came across this article, and at that time, we did not really have the resources to excavate a site like that or to take care of the things that would have come out of the ground. And if you can't properly care for the material that you take out of the ground, that material really should be left in the ground. Mm. So that's how it first came to light. Several decades later, about 20 years later, we got a new curator of anthropology and archaeology at the museum, and he was interested in Paleo Indians, in the Native Americans who were here during the time of the megafauna, during the Ice Age, and at the time of mammoths and mastodons. And he was told by a fellow who started volunteering for him, a fellow who had participated in the 1959 reconnaissance of this site. He was told about this site, and he figured, well, what better place to see if you can find any evidence of Paleo Indians than around a mastodon, which perhaps was hunted or scavenged. So they went there and they did a little digging and did a test pit and did not find any obvious evidence of human activity there. But they did find a caribou antler, so they knew they'd come down on an Ice Age level. And they also were given permission by the owner of the land to take back to the museum for a brief time bones and teeth that had been found in the 1959 reconnaissance that the museum had done at the time of the initial discovery. And because he felt that there was no real evidence of archaeological involvement here, he asked me, as the paleontologist, if I would be interested in looking at the site and possibly seeing if it could be opened. So that putting the door slightly open, I figured I did have a responsibility to try to do something. But fortuitously, what had happened about a year and a half before that is that the museum had set up a paleontology lab, a complete paleontology lab for my department, and it had brought in a professional conservator and paleontology technician to set up the lab and to train me in techniques. So that initial problem of not having the resources to be able to deal with anything with bones, let's say, that come out of the ground, that was now taken care of. We now had the logistical, we were now equipped to be able to deal with such a site. So I had no excuse not to go and see if it was possible to gain access to the site. And I went out there, and to my surprise and delight, the owner of the land said, yes, we could dig the site, and more importantly, we could keep the material that was found at the museum, for the museum, make it part of its collection. So that was everything we needed in order to do a proper professional excavation, scientific excavation of the site.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions. Firstly, you said that you were able to pick up the original fossils that had been dug up in the 50s. What had happened to them? Were they reburied?
Well, no, they were not reburied. When fossils are found on private land, excuse me, as a rule, they belong to the owner of the land. And the museum and the owner of the land could not come to an agreement as to the permanent disposition of those specimens. They stayed at the museum for some conservation work for perhaps 2 years in late 50s and the early 60s, but then they had to go back to the landowner, and they just stayed there on his property. And of course, he was not really set up to conserve them or do anything like that. So they stayed in a shed and you know, deteriorated to some degree. But then he seems to have had a change of, he clearly had a change of heart for whatever reason. And he became very much in favor of having the site excavated and having these materials treated as scientific objects.
Oh, that's really, really good news. Were you expecting that?
I was hoping that, but I did not have great hopes. I did not have great expectations when I went there. Something had changed in his attitude in those intervening 20 years, and we became very close friends. And he made a major contribution to science, in my opinion, and that's why we named the site after him and his family.
Okay, excellent. So you had these bones that had been originally collected, and yeah, we could see that it wasn't modern; that were more like Ice Age. You had the facilities now to be able to work the site and store all of this material, but what kind of purpose, why were you going there? What kinds of questions were you looking to answer? Was it simply just like, what is down there? How many more bones could we find?
Well, at that stage, my understanding is we were dealing with a site that had, quote, the Byron mastodon. Mastodon remains are not terribly rare, especially in the Northeast in North America. I don't mean you throw a stone and you hit one, but I mean it's not unusual to have a farmer say that he did some plowing or drained a marsh and found mastodon bones, usually mastodon rather than mammoth. So they're not terribly rare. But this, I guess it was a sense of responsibility. Since the site was now available and we had the resources to deal with it, as a scientific institution, I felt the Buffalo Museum of Science had a responsibility to go and to collect and study these remains. So that was why I went out there. It was really a matter of responsibility to the scientific community.
Okay. So you want to do this properly. You've been tasked with going there. How do you begin a significant excavation? I just really wouldn't know where to start. If someone said to me, there's a load of bones in that field over there, Dave, you go and dig them out, I just wouldn't know where to begin. So like, which kinds of challenges did you have to overcome before, you know, like actually getting out there and breaking ground?
Well, basically educating myself. I had my training made it clear to me what the main concerns would be. First of all, properly removing these objects from the ground, keeping very careful records so that in effect, if someone wanted to go back and put their finger on the exact spot where the object was found, they'd be able to do that. and removing the objects, collecting the objects and removing them in an orderly way, again, that which is necessary in order to keep those records clear. Once they're taken out of the ground, they can't be put back in again because the sediment has been removed, and the sediment contains much or most of the information about the environment in which the animal lived or died. So that much I knew. I understood we were going to have to establish a grid using stakes, sort of in effect lines of latitude and longitude, to make a map on the site. I understood that, but I'd never excavated from soft sediment. My experience had entirely been bedrock, corals and brachiopods and things like that. So I asked a lot of questions of our archaeologist, the fellow who had first gone and gotten access to this material, and I asked questions of other people also, people at other museums who had excavated mastodons. I wanted to make sure, for example, that I knew what type of consolidant to use. And we went through several types of consolidants. By consolidant, I mean a thin glue-like material that would harden and make the specimens strong enough to be able to handle and keep them from coming apart. So that's what I initially needed to do. I also was faced by a challenge that the site was underwater. It was a marsh. It was water which covered very soupy sediment, and I needed to consult with an engineer as to the best way to drain this water off that surface so we could work on it. So those were some of the challenges that I faced initially.
Yeah, I'd like to get into the sedimentology in a second, but really what strikes me is that it's a paleontological excavation, but using archaeological methods. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I just wanted to see, like from a physical, personal viewpoint, like what was it like to stand on the ground? Did you like sink down to your ankles? Was it that soft?
Well, we recognized clearly how soft it was. So whenever we went out on it, and what it was a big open area with just sort of pea soup practically. And so we took boards and laid them down on this soft sediment so that we could walk on them and stand on them. By the way, I there's something I should bring up at this point. A surprise that we found when we brought the specimens that had been found in 1959 back to the museum. I had a conservator, a lab technician, who I set to work on cleaning them and conserving them, treating them with consolidant. And as we were looking at them, I saw that there were two hip sockets. Now, these all came from an area, I'm going to say roughly maybe 10 by 20 feet and in area. So it was a fairly small area. And, you know, the surprise was that there were so many bones or bone fragments from there. But what I found when I picked up these two hip sockets was that one was a little bit larger than the other. And they were both left hip sockets. So this immediately told us that in that small area, there are the remains of more than one mastodon. And that completely changed our understanding of what the nature of this site was.
Oh, that's exciting. So did you just go by yourself? Did you have a team of assistants? How did the first excavation look?
Well, I sent out through the museum's literature a solicitation for volunteers, and we during the 2 weeks, initially we were working for 2 week periods. It became eventually 3 week periods. During those 2 weeks, I had, I think it was about 13 different people rotating in and out to come and help to work the site. And of course, we had to, it was on the job training. And fortunately, we had that volunteer who had worked with our archaeologist. Our archaeologist was Mike Gramley, but we had the volunteer who had worked with him and told him about the site, a gentleman named Jack Holland. And he came out there with us to sort of help us get started. So he helped us to understand the process of excavating soft sediment with a trowel and maintaining flat walls and things like that. So that first session, that first two-week period with the people who came into work was a learning experience.
And just to get in quickly, did you find anything there that first
Yes, we did. Everywhere we dug, we found bone, but mostly the bones were small bone fragments bones of small animals like frogs or rodents. And we did not go very deep because we were working near the edge of this basin. So we didn't go down much more than 2 feet before we reached what was clearly the basement, the level below which we were not going to find any more material. Everywhere we went, we did find fossils, and among those fossils on that level, basement surface, we did find what were clearly Macedon bone fragments.
Bingo. Yeah. So, did that, I mean, had you gone into this first season thinking that it just would be one season, or did the discovery of these mastodon bones allow you to go back the following year?
Yes, the discovery of this material did allow us to go back the second year. I mean, the museum was supporting us. What my expectation was that first year was just to see what was there. For all I knew, that would be it. But ultimately, what we wanted to do was to work our way toward the area where the 1959 reconnaissance had taken place, where the excavation had taken place. We started with our pits a short distance away from where we judged that reconnaissance had taken place, because I didn't want to take a chance on damaging valuable specimens or disrupting the stratigraphic column through inexperience. So these were more in the nature of test pits. But after that first field season, we were much more comfortable as to about how to go about our work there. We planned to go back for a second field season to see what would happen. And I had very strong support from the museum, especially from the director. And that was when a fortuitous event happened that provided us funding for the reliable funding for the next several years.
Okay. And until that point, though, I'm just trying to think of it from your perspective. You've now taken the control of the site. You've got volunteers that you've brought in to work it. You don't know if you're going to get another year. Like, what was that like? Like that uncertainty, and I guess how did it feel for you? Were you confident? Like, I am the person that is here to lead all of this. I know exactly what I'm doing, and everyone can trust me. Or was it really kind of flying by the seat of your pants and doing and hoping that what you were doing was the best?
Well, I would say that, because of my relative inexperience in this type of excavating, I felt comfortable asking questions and asking for help, which I did receive. I didn't feel like my ego was going to be bruised if I asked questions. I had very strong support from the museum. And I was confident that at least for another field season, we'd go back in. And as I mentioned, our aim was to work our way slowly toward where that initial reconnaissance was done, knowing that we certainly would find something there, though we did not really know what we would find. So we took it a year at a time, but in that early stage, I really didn't know how reliable funding would be, how much I could count on. And it did not really involve a tremendous financial investment at that point. Later on, as we began to get involved with radiocarbon dating, and as we needed to have assistance, living in the field and things like that, and more equipment, it did become somewhat more expensive. But at that stage, I felt that we would be able to continue for a while working on a shoestring, but doing things responsibly. And I think that's the way it would have turned out if we didn't get the funding.
Okay, so you did get the funding. And over the next few minutes now, as we work through this interview, I think it'd be nice to work our way through the sedimentology and then the fossils in the same way that you would have done there. You have to look at the sediments and you eventually find the fossils as well. But ultimately, how long did you dig at the site for?
How many years? 29 years.
So it kept on being successful.
Yes, yes. It was each year there was some significant discovery. And it was, yes, each year was quite successful. Yes.
Excellent. And was it always conditional on you finding that something worthwhile? Were there any years that you just found nothing and you thought, oh, this is the last year? Or was it just like you have the money to fully explore this site?
Well, we almost toward the end, we did have the money to fully explore the site. We did come to a point where our funding dried up. That particular source of funding, which came from a local Buffalo Family Foundation. Beyond that point, I needed to raise money myself, but we were still able to continue working, though a little bit, on a somewhat smaller budget. I'd say each year had something of note, and our idea was to continue working as long as there was something to work on. Since everywhere we dug, we found something of significance. There was no reason not to go back and to continue doing it as long as there were people willing to come and join me, and as long as we did have the funding to do this work. There was one year, and that's reflected in the book, where I felt that we really had not found anything of great significance. And I thought we were now coming out of the areas where the really important finds would be made. It turned out I was wrong about that, but I didn't know that for another couple of years. So I would say that every year had some measure of significant contribution to human knowledge is the best way I can put it.
That's awesome. And it blows my mind to think that you were there for essentially three decades. You started before I was born and you finished, maybe only, when did you finish? Like 10 years ago or something?
The last field season was in 2011. And I finished curating that collection in 2012.
Wow. Yeah, so, yeah, for an enormous part of my life, you were digging that site. It's unbelievable that it went on for so long. And I think that's, yeah, probably testament to how many important bones you found down there.
Yes.
So, if we can work through the site now, so we're just starting off. We've just broken ground. We're looking to work towards that initial pit that was dug in the 50s. So we're digging through the sediments. what are we going to see? What's it like? What kinds of different sediments were there?
Well, initially, I really only recognized, I'd say, two, or in a way, maybe three levels of sediment. Where we were digging during the first year, 1983, essentially we had dark, peaty, which means plant-rich earth, covering a very peculiar surface that almost looked like a cobblestone road. It was sort of an armor of cobbles all pressed against one another, beneath which was a light-colored, silty material in which these cobbles were buried. And below that surficial armor of cobbles, there were other cobbles and sometimes even boulders, but they were more sparsely distributed. They were, I'd say, floating within the matrix, whereas the ones on the top were pressed against each other. So that was our basement. And although we would test in each pit to see, to make sure there wasn't anything hiding underneath that, that was clearly the basement below, above which the fossil bearing deposits were laid down. In that first year, the pits were very shallow because we were near the margin. And when we went back for the second year, I realized I needed to get an idea of what was going on if in other areas of the site, if there were deeper areas, and it seemed likely if they were, that they would be further in toward the middle of this basin. So I set a crew to work in the middle of the basin, digging a pit, or toward the middle of the basin, and another crew to working on the margin where we had worked the previous year. I wanted to see, I hoped that if the pit was deeper in toward the middle of the basin, that there would be a thicker sedimentary column, and that in effect the layers would be more diffuse, or rather more spread out, and we would be able to more clearly identify what the layers were. And in fact, that turned out to be what happened. When in that more central area, the pit was more in the neighborhood of 4 feet, 4.5 feet deep, rather than foot and a half to 2 feet where it was near the margin. And here we could actually see a better representation of the strata that were there. What we eventually wound up with was an upper layer that was peaty, that was plant rich, but it was basically black soil, and it did not have a lot of large pieces of wood.
So this is us digging down now.
This is digging from the surface, yes. Below that was a layer of similar peaty material, but here there were more large pieces of wood, quite a lot of significant pieces of wood, fragments of branches and so on. Beneath that, there was a gray material, a gray layer that was sort of mixed, believe it or not, pebbles, cobbles, and silt, everything you could imagine. And it was gray colored, sort of a brownish gray. And that turned out to be the layer that was the Pleistocene layer, the fossil-bearing Pleistocene layer. But it was not represented in the shallower pits over near the margin. Mm. And then on the bottom of that, there was what we call the basement layer, which was this light gray, silty material with pebbles and cobbles in it.
Okay, so I'm just imagining kind of like a dish basin shape now, and then these different layers within it, but only the deepest bit of the dish had this mixed layer in which we found the fossils.
Yes. I should add, by the way, that second layer, which we eventually call the woody layer, that layer that contained large pieces of wood that was post-ice age, eventually found it was a little bit more complicated because in certain areas it had an older component that had a different texture to it. And also in certain areas toward the bottom of it, it had a peculiar sort of what we call the yellow clay. It was a clay-rich, pebble-rich material that turned out to reflect a burning event at a particular time during the post-Ice Age, during the Holocene.
Yeah, it sounds like the your understanding of this deposit really has evolved and keeps evolving as you went from the first year into the following years. Was that the case? Did it always kind of change? Was it an easy deposit to get your head around what was going on?
Well, you're absolutely right. My understanding of it, my perception of it did change. We established a vocabulary for it, and that vocabulary really didn't change. What changed was our recognition of certain, let's say, members within the formation, to use the geological terms, that were not, you know, did not occur everywhere. They occurred sporadically, apparently because of periodic erosion. But yes, my understanding of those layers, and especially of what some of them actually represented, especially that that gray deposit, that gray fossiliferous Pleistocene deposit, that my understanding of that really didn't fully develop until pretty late on in the dig.
Okay, so I'm getting the impression that it is difficult to separate out these layers, especially as you were saying, you didn't recognize some of the boundaries within that layer that was filled with wood. Now, obviously, we would have lots of different methods for doing that, such as say like the radiocarbon dating and whatnot. There'd be tons of ways to find out in the modern day how to do that. But yeah, this dig took over 30 years to do. So how difficult was it? How long did it take you to figure out? I know you've said that it you were still figuring it out towards the latter stages, but to get, you know, like a workable idea of what was going on, how long did it take to come up with that? And then when were you able to, and how were you able to get, you know, like solid dates and really figure out what each layer represented and how old it was?
Well, I would say by the end of the second field season, the field season in which we dug that pit toward the closer to the middle of the basin, I had a pretty good, I had a generally good picture understanding of the general stratigraphy of the site. And later, you know, beyond that, it was simply being modified, you know, as per details. Because of a particular find we made in that second field season, some other scientists came in to work with me, specifically from the New York State Museum. And they had experience with radiocarbon dating, which I did not have. And they guided me in getting specimens of wood from the different layers that we radiocarbon dated. So for the first time, we were now able to put absolute ages, absolute dates on the different horizons within that stratigraphic column.
Okay, so can we work through it layer by layer to just get a decent understanding of what's going on? If we do it chronologically as the rocks were laid down, and then we can see how the deposit evolved over time, how it changed over time. So if we start at the bottom, so this cobbly cobblestone road, essentially, like how did it form, how old was it, and then what environment did it represent, and then we try and work our way through time towards the present as the basin filled up.
Well, that cobblestone road was an armor that formed on what I understand is referred to as a diamicton, which is a debris that is left behind after the glacier has moved, has melted back, has receded. It was sort of a combination of probably some moraine, but to a large extent, and probably mostly proglacial lake deposits. The water material that was deposited as the glacier was melting back was receding, and material was melting out of the glacier. So there would be rock flour that would account for the fine silt, and pebbles and cobbles as well that had been incorporated in the glacier. That is what the cobble layer would have been. The cobblestone surface, or the cobblestone road surface, as I refer to it, that covered it. To me, I think what's strongly suggested here is that there was some sort of an erosional event in which the fine material was weathered out, eroded out from between the rocks, going down to a certain depth, and the rocks, the cobbles settled down to form this dense cover on top of it. Just with the nature, what was going on at that point? Well, there's a lot more water moving around as the glaciers were melting back, so that probably had something to do with what caused that. As to how old the cobble layer is, that is best judged by the age of the radiocarbon dates we got from the layer covering it. And the oldest radiocarbon date we got there was a little over 11,500 BP. So which in terms of calendar dates would be something closer to 13,500 calendar years, because radiocarbon years and calendar years do not exactly equate. So that the cobble layer precedes, in terms of radiocarbon dates, precedes, let's say, 11,500 radiocarbon years. We know from other evidence that the glacier was covering this area, Western New York, till roughly 13,000, 12,500 radiocarbon years ago. We have that from dates elsewhere. So the cobble layer dates to somewhere between, I'd say, 12,500 and 11,500 radiocarbon years ago.
I'm just trying to zoom into my geological timescale. It's right at the very top. It's pretty hard to see. So what age, period, epoch kind of thing would that represent? Is it Pleistocene sort of ice age?
It's at the very tail end of the tail end of the Pleistocene. The Pleistocene dates back to 10,700 years ago. You know, currently, that's the way we use that. I'm used to thinking of the Pleistocene as having ended about 10,000 years ago, when the glaciers had melted back from the mid latitudes in North America. But the accepted age now is in the neighborhood of 10,700 radiocarbon years for the end of the Pleistocene. So strictly speaking, our ice age layer straddles the latest part of the Pleistocene and the very earliest, just a few of the earliest years of the following, the Holocene.
Right, okay. And then the next layer up, the one that has all the fossils in it, that was a similar age, yeah?
Yes. Well, just to finish up, the ice age, the so-called ice age layer, that gray gravelly clay layer, which, by the way, was suffused with short twigs that puzzled us for quite a long time. That layer, the youngest dates we got from that layer were around in the 9,000 year range. Above that, there's a layer that we call the older woody layer. Remember, I mentioned the woody layer because it has a lot of wood in it. It turns out there's a lower part of that which dates from roughly 9,000 to 8,000 radiocarbon years ago. And then there's a break of about 6,000 years in the stratigraphic record. And Beyond that, we come into what we call the younger woody layer, which begins at roughly 2,000 years ago, although most of the dates that we have from there fall around 1,000 and younger. Then when we get up to the uppermost layer, that what we call the dark earth, that reflects, we believe, the time of European settlement when the forests were cleared from the land. So that's why you don't have so much significant large pieces of wood in the sediment. And that begins roughly 200 years ago.
Okay, wow. I'm just trying to think of what actually happened 200 years ago. It'd be the 1800s.
The Byron area was settled. People started coming in there and settling there roughly around 1810, 1811.
Okay. Wow. So there's plenty of distinct layers of history in there. And did you get fossil evidence or historical evidence? I don't quite know where the cutoff is in there for each different layer. Was it really well separated so that it was incredibly distinct? If it came from this layer, it was this age, it was this environment. If it came from this one, it was here. Was it that easy to work with?
Well, yes and no. The each layer did have its specific we'll say fauna and flora, as your William Smith showed us who showed us back in the early 1800s with the principle of fossil correlation.
That was at the same time that the upper layer of your deposit was being formed.
Exactly. And I actually found myself using his technique, his principles, in a way that, you know, more precisely than I had expected to. That's another story. But what we found is we need to be very careful about assuming that a specimen is of the same age, that the layer in which you find a specimen indicates its age. In general, it did, and if we saw no evidence to the contrary, we would assume that was the case. However, in a fair number of cases, we found that specimens had intruded down into lower layers. And initially, we were disturbed by this. The reason this was happening, well, a couple of reasons. One way you'd get that intrusion would be if something had settled down into a burrow, if there was burrowing that went on there at various times, and an object could settle down into a burrow. Another way it could happen was because during a large part of its history, this site was wet, either underwater or at least very damp. So it was easy for things to get impressed down into the sediment. And in one particular case, we found what we affectionately referred to as the ice mouse. It was a rodent jaw, a rodent larger than a mouse, that we found down in the ice age layer, and it had the color that was typical of fossils we found down in the ice age layer, sort of a yellowish brown color, light yellowish brown color. And we were pretty excited. We thought this is just great. We actually have some sort of a rodent, a large rodent down in from the ice age. Then we radiocarbon dated it, and it turned out to be about 450 radiocarbon years old. So something was amiss here. And this was one of the examples we found. We'd actually found one or two before that where we saw that you could not necessarily assume that the layer in which you find something was the layer in which reflected the surface on which it had originally been deposited. So as I said, we found this disconcerting and disappointing, but then eventually we came to realize that this was actually a godsend. The reason I say that is that in a number of cases, a fair number of cases, what was being intruded down into those lower layers was something that would have been destroyed if it had remained on the surface. we were finding things that radiocarbon dated to that period, that 6,000 year period, for which we did not have a sedimentary record, because they had been intruded down into the ground, perhaps in a couple of cases, for example, branches of trees that had jammed down into the ground, into the soft sediment, we could see something of what was going on there during those 6,000 years, botanically and faunally.
Okay, so just thinking of that as a working example, you have your oldest Pleistocene layers filled with mastodon bones, and yet you have, say, a tree branch from 6,000 years ago nestled with it, giving a radiocarbon dating of 6,000 years ago. So obviously your mammoths weren't 6,000... Mastodon, sorry, I always get those confused. Your mastodon weren't 6,000 years ago, but they were lying next to a branch that was 6,000 years old.
Exactly. I'll give you one example. In one particular case, we had two mastodon ribs that were sort of crossed over each other, and a branch, about a 4-foot-long branch of ash wood, had jammed down into the ground and struck and shattered one of those mastodon ribs. The mastodon ribs dated to, if I recall correctly, something like 10,007, 10,009 radiocarbon years ago. And the ash wood dated to something like 800 or 900 years old. So here you had an intersection of things that had lived roughly 10,000 years apart, intersecting due to an event in which a tree had apparently fallen down and a branch had jammed down and struck this mastodon rib.
That's amazing. So for those of you who know what my job is, I do stratigraphy. I do biostratigraphy. It's my job to, you know, like figure out the relative ages of rock. And a principle that we have is that old stuff can work its way into younger stuff. Say, like, if a fossil was laid down and later on it was eroded out of a rock and then found its way into a new rock that lies older than it. But it never works the other way. Younger fossils don't get into older rocks. But then here we're not dealing with rocks. We're dealing with sediments. And those aren't consolidated. They're not, you know, like cemented geologically. They're not set geologically. And so, yeah, you can have this mixing.
True. Although at some point, if these survive long enough, I think that these sediments would become lithified, and they, you know, if they lasted long enough, and then you could find what appears to be intrusion down, you know, in a hard rock context. So it calls, I think, for care in all cases and examination. You look at the general relationships, and I think you can generally trust them, but it's always important to be prepared to go back and revisit your conclusions, as I've found many, many times.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, it's all a testament to how complex this site was and how difficult it must have been to, you know, figure it out day by day, year by year, as to what exactly is happening when you've got so many anachronistic events all flying around everywhere. It's amazing that what you've been able to figure out about the history of this site over, you know, all of these different layers of sediment.
I'd have to intrude here just for a moment. Speaking of intrusion, I figured things out, but I never could have really figured things out to the degree that is reflected in this book without working with numerous other scientists, each of whom had an expertise in, you know, in one field or another, and who very generously helped to guide me when I had a question, when I was not sure about something. This was a case. I didn't go into this with the with the plan of, you know, making it getting as many scientists involved as possible. But as I needed help, I would ask for it, and people came in and lent their expertise and worked with me, some for years. So it is truly a multidisciplinary effort, and it does not reflect by any means, my knowledge or my abilities. It involves that of many people.
Right then. So let's have a look at some of the fauna and flora that you were digging up. So you've mentioned a few things so far, but obviously the biggest, the most impressive, there we go, fossils that we've talked about so far are those of the mastodon. Those were what were originally dug up, what were exciting, those and caribou, perhaps, I think you said. Mm-hmm. But were those the kinds of things that you were really after, the big, showy, impressive mammals?
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.